We return now to Terry Gross's 1991 interview with Norman Mailer. He has a new book, The Spooky Art, Thoughts on Writing.
You went from Harvard into the Army. I think you fought in the Philippines during World War II.
Yes.
Was that the first time that physical strength counted more than intellectual ability in your life?
I would say so, yes. In fact, I went through... I grew up in Brooklyn, and, you know, we didn't ignore strength in Brooklyn, but it wasn't. I grew up in a reasonable neighborhood, reasonable middle-class neighborhood. But I do think that the what counted for more than strength or the lack of it was the fact that I went from Brooklyn to Harvard to the Army. So I went through two major transitions in 5 years. And the shock of that, and then a few years later, The Naked and the Dead was written and came out. So in a space of about 8 years, I went through three major transitions. The third being that I went from being an unknown young man to who just recently gotten out of the Army to being a young celebrity. And that was the largest transition of them all. It was extraordinary.
How did who you saw yourself as being compare when you were in Harvard and when you were in the Army?
Well, I just had a totally different view of myself. You know, young people at Harvard. Harvard was a wonderful place in those days, and you were coddled a bit. You know, we were treated as gentlemen. We were treated as young people who are going to be, without ever saying it, the assumption was that we were going to play a reasonably interesting role in life. And everybody cultivated everyone else's opinion. I remember it as an incredibly polite place and very nice. And even if you were discriminated against, you never knew it. It was all done so subtly. Whereas the Army, of course, was rough as a corn cob. And so that was a huge transition. And then I wasn't very good in the Army. I wasn't a good soldier. And I'd gone from having a rather elevated opinion of myself to a poor opinion of myself. So my ego was on the elevator in those days.
In what way weren't you a good soldier?
Oh, I just resented close-order drill completely. I don't think I ever learned to march properly or present arms or any of that stuff. And I just wasn't a particularly good soldier. If you had 12 soldiers in a platoon, I'd be the third or the fourth from the bottom.
Was it important to you as a writer to be in the Army and meet men who weren't like you, who weren't from the same background or the same region?
Oh, I think it turned me into an altogether different kind of writer. If I'd never gone to the Army, I believe I would have written novels that probably would have been a little bit like the works of Iris Murdoch. Maybe not as good, but I would have had intricate philosophical novels with characters who, to say the least, would be somewhat extreme and distorted and intense. And going into the Army, talking in quick terms, maybe much more of a naturalist.
Was your ego intact after the military when you started to write?
No, I went through my ego was battered, and I went through the war very much with the attitude of, when I get out, I'm going to write a book about it, expose this damn Army. Now, everybody I knew in the Army was saying the same thing, but I used to think, yeah, they're saying it, but I'm going to do it. And I hated the Army. Now, looking back on it, I'd say that the Army was the 2 years that I spent in the Army were the worst experience of my life and the most valuable.
You know, you said your ego was on the elevator, you know, between Harvard and the Army. It really started to be on the elevator when you started to write. You know, The Naked and the Dead, as you say, made you into celebrity, but your next two books weren't reviewed as favorably, didn't sell as well. What kind of mood swings did that create in you?
Well, huge mood swings, but the happy end to the story is that by now I have an ego that I'm afraid is like a battleship. Just try and sink it.
Is it good or bad for a writer to have a big ego?
It has its advantages. Obviously, you can go through a mess of bad reviews. And, you know, most of my books over the years have had more bad reviews than good reviews. I'm the only major writer in America who has had more bad reviews than good reviews in the course of his writing life. So that gives me a certain a pride in it. They keep taking their shot, their best shot, and they can't do a goddamn thing. They're not going to stop me. And, you know, and you can get a little vain about it that way. But the bad part about having a tough ego is you become less percipient. Ego is a shell, essentially. And so you start to close off experience from yourself. The ideal would be to have a light, flexible ego that's there, that can concentrate in a given place to protect you when the going gets tough, but that it doesn't cut off too much. At my worst, I often feel like a turtle. I just pull my head in and let it rattle off the shell.
Right.
But, of course, I'm not seeing a damn thing except my own darkness at that point.
The writer Blanche McCreary Boyd had an appreciation of your work recently in The Village Voice. She wrote, Mailer's work has demonstrated an aggressive sexism, and he has, as a consequence, become a cultural icon of offensiveness about women. Do you think you deserve to be a cultural icon of offensiveness about women?
Well, why don't you read the rest of her
review? Oh, she loved your work. No, I just thought this was one way of getting to this issue. I should say here, she really loves your work and the new novel as well, just to put this into context.
Well, I just shrug when we get into that because she started with that to show the distance that the book took her.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as she read the book, as I understood her review, she was saying, in effect, I'm beginning to forgive him more and more because this book is so good. And finally, at the end, she was saying, it hardly matters what I think his ideas and his attitudes are toward women. I just, I love this book because it just keeps me reading and so forth and so forth. Whatever. It's hard for me to talk about a good review. After all, a man my age who's preening is kind of silly. But as far as the... as far as being an icon of the awful to a lot of women's liberationists, yes, it's absolutely true, but I also think it's silly. I don't think they read me. I think they proceed on a notion of me that's very little to do with what I really write about all the time. I think if they were to read what I write, they'd be startled. On the other hand, I think the worst of the women's liberationists are incapable of reading. They're interested only in political correctness. So how the hell can they read?
I want to read something that you wrote in the 1950s in Advertisements for Myself. You wrote, Fitzgerald was an indifferent caretaker of his talent, and I have been a cheap gambler with mine. As I add up the accounts, I cannot like myself too much, for I was cowardly when I should have been good and too brave on many a bad chance. And I spent my first 30 years abusing my body, and the last 6 in forced marches on my brain. And so I am more stupid today than I ought to be. My memory is half gone, and my mind is slow. From fear and vanity, I paid out too much for what I managed to learn. I may have wasted too much of myself, and if I have, what a loss. Can you update that for us? Do you ever feel like, do you ever feel those kinds of emotions that you expressed when you were 36 in that passage?
No. In the act of writing that, I was able to move away from that. You know, much of writing is I wouldn't call it exorcism, but it is transformation. Very occasionally, it's transcendence. If you can absolutely capture a state of mind at a given moment, then you very often are freed of that state of mind. That was written out of the deep fear. In those years, it was written out of the deep fear that I'd ruined myself.
From
these abuses, you know, pot, booze, all of that. But I think in the course of writing it, some little part of me said, well, stop complaining so much because actually this is rather a well-written passage.
At the age of 68, which you are now, do you feel that you have no time for certain shenanigans that you participated in when you were younger?
Oh, time is obsessive now. Not obsessive, that's too strong a word, but it's present in almost every thought I have, put it that way. I don't know how much longer I have, 10 years, 15 years at most, and there's so many things I want to get done yet. So, no, I have no time for shenanigans. I've got to get the work out.
Has your approach to writing and rewriting changed at all over the years?
Talking about the process.
Yeah.
Well, I now look upon myself as having somewhat less talent than I had when I in the middle years, but I have much more skill and savvy, and I'm a much better editor of my own work. I'm sure that any number of reviewers would disagree, but in any event, that's the way I feel. And so I feel if I can get something written that's halfway decent, by the time I get done editing it, it'll be pretty good. Whereas in the old days, I used to write with more smoke and less savvy.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It went very quickly.
Norman Mailer, speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Today, he turns 80. Mailer has a new book, The Spooky Art, Thoughts on Writing. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.